morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me,
right, Mike Cosentino. You know, the coolest thing about Martin Luther King Day is that it's not that big a deal anymore. And that's exactly what it should be. It should be just like, you know, remember when you were little, you know, President's Day, Roosevelt, you know, all those, Lincoln's birthday, Washington's birthday. It was just a day off. This is Martin Luther King Day. We still are here on the radio. It's just a nice...
Martin Luther King live at a church in St. Louis. It was an astonishing performance, astonishing event. I was so young that when they passed the things that they do in churches with the little baskets for money for contributing to the civil rights, I was sort of insulted. I thought we should be totally high-minded. And I thought, yeah, they're raising money to do the civil rights stuff. And I thought, God, I was young then, you know?
I would propose a different point of view on MLK Day, and that I think there's a whole lot of work to do. I think we've backslid a great deal with racism, and I think it needs more attention.
It's kind of a, I don't think history repeats itself, but it is a kind of spiral where things come around again, and with Black Lives Matter in some way is a resonance of the earlier civil rights struggle, right?
And we've resegregated to a huge degree. We're now back, in terms of segregation, back to the days prior to the Civil Rights Act, the days of Jim Crow.
You're right, of course, but my point was that, you know, in Arizona was such a struggle. I mean, I think we're one of the last states to...
I think the last.
We were the last.
And so in that vein, it's become a normal holiday.
No, I think that's a good point.
Does it represent... Yes, absolutely.
Not the end of the world.
Yeah. It's just, you know, just a cool holiday here in, what is this, January?
Yeah, but we do want to talk about the end of the world today. Or
we do. Well, we want to talk about the Republicans' view of the end of the world. You know, I'm going to, after 8 years, Obama has delivered so much brilliant oratory that we take it for granted. But this speech was killer, and especially what we're going to do this morning, as Williamson had the idea here, of contrasting the incredible dark view that, you know, the sky is falling, the brown people are going to kill you if they don't, the turban people are going to kill you in your sleep, the economy's going to, I mean, the dark view. We want to talk about, President Obama talked about the future in his State of the Union speech. We're going to talk a little bit about that in case you missed it, in case it got buried in the avalanche of the usual Republican rhetoric. I don't get it. I guess I do get it. You just
So we're going to contrast these two views, this sort of dark, apocalyptic, furiously angry vision that's coming from particularly from Ted Cruz but also Rubio has now joined all the conspiracy nut stuff, and so it's the darkest in the sense of the shadow side of America that I've ever seen a political party appeal to. I mean, I wasn't around for the McCarthy era or something, but it is. So I say, but let's talk about what the president said. And the problem Republicans have is the fact is that when President Obama went into office, and unemployment was about 10%, it's now about 5%.
In spite of, by the way, 8 years of no jobs bill from the Republicans. I mean, you know, no jobs bill. And he said during the speech that he believed the thriving private sector. He kind of at least tried to assuage the fears that he's a Mike Cosentino socialist and would like to see more government jobs. But you can have a thriving private sector and still have jobs programs. We have done it for 60, 70, 80 years.
Budget deficit is still high, but it's half of what it was when he came into office.
Exactly.
ISIS is still a deadly force in the world with terrorism, particularly now switching from Europe to Africa and also, of course, the U.S. But they've lost about 40% of their territory and tens of thousands of their fighters. And they made enemies all over the whole Middle East.
They even bombed their bank.
Yeah.
Blew up all their cash.
We blew up all their money, is not a bad idea.
And as far as Americans are concerned, you're more likely to be killed by a domestic terrorist than you are a foreign.
I think the chances of being killed are several million to one by getting killed by a terrorist. Yet the Republicans are stroking this incredible fear of terrorism. The president, one of the things which you should talk about, Mike, is the president said, look, ISIS can be a threat to individual Americans. There's no doubt about that. That's obvious. ISIS is a threat to most people in the world who are not fanatical crazies. But it's no existential threat. It's no threat to the United States. It is, in fact, a tiny organization. There are more, I think, about 320 million Americans now. And there's been very little impact from it, except in our overreaction, right, Mike?
Exactly. And that seems to be, but fear works. Fear works. It worked well for the Bush administration, really well. Kept him in office when he shouldn't have gone out in 2004. But so in the speech, talked about.
We didn't turn on Bush when 9/11 happened. We didn't turn on Bush then.
Yeah, looking
back, I remember Democrats
in
New York. I was saying that was a good speech he gave down at Ground Zero. It was only when he decided to invade Iraq, which had nothing to do with it, that people really began to.
Well, he squandered every scrap of goodwill that America had as a result of 9/11. When you start rendition, torture as a tool. Invading other countries that produced the hell that we're living through today. Mm-hmm. And he was told that removing Saddam Hussein would cause
exactly what's
happening. Some
things were really obvious, Mike, and getting rid of Saddam Hussein was obviously going to cause this battle between the Shiites and the Sunnis in Iraq.
There's a wonderful article called "Blind into Baghdad" in the Atlantic Monthly in 2003. It outlined exactly what's happening today. Not that there wasn't plenty of people that did. Obama talked about three things. How do we give everyone a fair shot at security in this new economy? And he said this new economy isn't something that's just happened. This is a new economy that didn't just happen as a result of the crash of the Great Depression. I understand that during the 30s Depression, 25% of Americans were out of work, where we hit, depending on who's counting, we got into the high teens, but officially we got into the 10 or 11 range.
There's always a debate, folks, about that Mike's referring to about unemployment statistics. And unemployment statistics are they basically poll people and they ask them if they looked for work this month. Are they actively looking for work? So when you see a percentage, it's the people who say that they've looked for work. So there's an argument, and because nobody is able to really measure it very well, I don't think, Mike, is the number of people who have been discouraged from looking for work because the job opportunities are not there. With unemployment at 5%, there should be jobs out
there.
That's
generally considered full employment.
Yeah. Because there's always going to be 5% of the workforce. But we're also talking about underemployment. And because of the nature of technology, we have lots of people that are and our education system, we have lots of people underemployed. In other words,
of the fast food jobs and stuff are just as dead end as they don't pay well like factory jobs used to.
Well,
the unions, but they don't. But they're just as dead end, most of them.
Well, that's it. I mean, you talk to my Chuck Vicani, my Italian buddy from New York, Republican. He would say, well, they're not meant to be permanent jobs. These are just, well, you know what? They are permanent jobs for lots of people who are supporting families. If it was some sort of high school thing that your parents were paying the bills and whatnot, and it was a second or third or fourth.
Yeah, we all had high school jobs.
There you go.
But what else did the president say?
You should be able to support. He said three things. He said that, he said many things, but how do we give everybody a shot to an opportunity and security in this new economy that's coming? How do we make technology work for us and not against us, especially when it comes to climate change as the biggest security threat? All of these squabbles between Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Barack Obama, and Mitch McConnell don't amount to a hill of beans when, the kinds of horrors that climate change could cause. The third thing he mentioned was, how do we keep America safe without becoming its policeman?
So he's saying, really, we can use technology and renewable energy, that climate change is a terrible challenge to the whole world, but that there is a positive aspect to it if we respond in a positive, proactive way of moving to renewable energy and cutting the kinds of emissions that are causing it. I liked his line where he basically said, you know, you can deny climate change,
right,
but basically, you know, right. The whole world disagrees with you at this point, all the scientists pretty much, and most of the American public.
You know, so it's the insanity of America going its own way all the time, this unilateral thing. And we're proud of it. We're proud of our ignorance. I just saw another article this morning on anti-intellectualism. That one, you know, somebody's got to understand. Somebody's got to explain that to me. Explain how stupid it became such a virtue.
It's a long tradition in the United States.
Stupidity
of
virtue.
So is, to be honest, any federal government, any government at all, is a strain in the American politics. It really doesn't exist a lot of places in Europe. I mean, in places of Europe, they take a more natural view, which is government's there to help you. And the question is what you want it to do, and that's what you have the big battles.
And that's all we're asking. That's all Democrats are asking here. Shows like Democratic Perspective, 4 years on the air, we're still doing two things. We're pointing out the incredible amount of lies that are coming from the other side. And that we're asking, you know, why can't we see government as you just said, a tool to help us?
I agree with you, Mike, but it's not just. I think we need to look at the individual lies, which is what I think you're referring to. But we also need to see the pattern emerging when people like Cruz and Trump emphasize all negative all the time. So the negotiations so far with Iran have worked out. The American hostages were released even as the Republicans were denouncing Obama for not releasing them. And there's all this really petty kind of, the old term when I was growing up was unmanly complaining. In other words, I mean, 14 months of hard negotiations to get those people out, and you got a lot of people just shooting off their mouth, claiming that they could do it so much better or that it was never going to happen. And then when it does happen, then they say, well, we don't like it anyway.
I think you're right about the pattern. I think we need to look at the lies, not individually. I've spent a lot of time, you know, as you know,
taking them on one by one.
Yes, and writing about them, researching them. But I think we have to look at them and as a whole, as tools that they use in order to shape the public opinion. It's really clearly propaganda. And so if I can use all of the right wing radio, Fox News, all of the blogosphere and chain emails to create distrust amongst, you know, the base, I can manipulate them with, you know, to do what I wish.
I think that's
so what's
true.
What's the name of your book, Gary?
Well, the new one is called Fact Free Politics.
And it's about?
It's about all of the lies and trying to tie the lies together to show that they are indeed a part of a bigger plan of propaganda.
You know, the Democratic perspective inspired our colleague here so much that he's written a big-ass book.
500-plus pages.
When's it going to be available?
It will be out next month.
We're going to do a whole show on Gary's book, and we'll be interviewing our colleague here about his book. And we've done that before when he put his first book
out. It'll be a much more exciting interview.
You'll yell at him?
Because I'll yell at him, yeah. I'll look forward to it. I got pom-poms. I'm going to be cheering. one of the things that I...
That's yelling for, not yelling
against. One of the hopeful, positive, one of the parts that made Obama's speech so great, and you know, and just such a nice roadmap. You know, gee, guys, we didn't get along very well the last 7 years. Maybe we can get along then. And he said, and he does a self-deprecating thing, which of course Americans don't get. They think it's a sign of weakness that, you know, maybe a Roosevelt or a Lincoln could have found a way to work with these idiots. No, Barack, Roosevelt or Lincoln could not have found a way to work with
people. The establishment is still sort of beating up on the media for him not negotiating enough Republicans and stuff. Democrats, folks, think, good, you know, what was he supposed to do to negotiate with these guys? You can't negotiate with Ted Cruz type people.
Not even Teddy Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan could negotiate with these folks.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard on the BBC the other night talking about the economy after oil. I would love to hear that somewhere in the United States because Barack Obama certainly referred to it. But
he was really honest about cutting down coal production, wasn't he?
Yes.
About leaving a lot of that the most polluting coal products in the ground because of the amount of pollution.
Who would have thought we'd see oil at $28 a barrel?
Yeah.
That's
something we should discuss sometime, the collapse of the oil price.
Well, we need to get your banker brother in.
Actually, I read a story this morning about how the collapse of oil prices is creating problems for the big banks again because they've invested so much money into small oil companies.
See, no, I thought those
they're talking bailout again, perhaps.
Oh, talk about emotional investments. See, I thought these guys were supposed to be cold, calculating businessmen.
It's all about quick profit, Mike.
Who would invest in oil in 2015?
You don't worry about what
Barack Obama said 7 years ago, we made the biggest investment in clean energy in our history. Here are the results. In the fields from Iowa to Texas, where wind power is now cheaper than dirtier conventional power. On rooftops of Arizona to New York, solar on my house is saving Americans tens of millions of dollars a year on their energy bills and employs more Americans than coal. Let me say it again. Solar energy employs more Americans than coal in jobs that pay better than average. We're taking steps to give homeowners the freedom to generate and store their own energy, something environmentalists and Tea Partiers have teamed up to support. Meanwhile, we cut our imports of foreign oil by nearly 60%. This was a dream of Americans 15 years ago.
Years ago, when I was working as a tour guide, the guides were all complaining that the high oil prices were caused by Obama.
And gas is under $2 a gallon. I paid $1.69. with my supermarket discount.
I said, I would like to argue with you guys that the president really doesn't have much to do. I mean, I would like to say, oh, Obama has cut the price of oil a dollar. Every time you buy a gallon of gasoline, you're saving a dollar now. It's pumping a tremendous amount of money into the American economy. It's like everybody was given a raise. So if you calculate about what your mileage is a year, you get an idea of how much of extra money you're going to have just by this cut in prices. But also it is dangerous because of the – in other words, I guess I really liked Obama's speech, and I never listened to them live. I do it on the Internet and read the speeches. I really liked it. It's optimistic, but there are – it's not that the conservatives are totally wrong, that there are no challenges out there. China is in real trouble. That's going to reverberate through the world economy. Obama is absolutely correct. We have the strongest economy in the industrialized world. We have the strongest army in the world. We have spend more money than the next, 12 countries, Gary?
It's the next eight
countries.
And of those, the next nine, and of those, seven of them are allies.
But that doesn't mean that the extremism you see with ISIS and with the revival of Al-Qaeda, although I think most of the original members of Al-Qaeda are all dead now, it's the people inspired by that. These are serious problems. The cut in oil prices that's so good for us in some way, there's a big collapse as the Chinese stop buying raw materials around the world that we don't really know what it's going to mean yet. So it's not that there aren't huge challenges out there.
Well, it's not that there's not going to be a transition. He, a lot of his speech was geared toward making the transition and making it together. Two things. We started down the road of America being unilateral and not 200 other countries admitting and doing something about climate change, and yet the Republicans, the outliers, the only entity in the world that still is some sort of denial of the is the Republican Party of the United States. And it's that way on so many things. Gun control saves lives around the world, and yet we're still killing 88 people a day.
Including a road rage and killing in Phoenix the other night.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, Mike.
Thank you. The other thing I liked is he turned this little simple phrase, and this is where the brilliance comes in, by the way, boys and girls. We the people. You know, people have been taking that phrase of the beginning of the Constitution and somehow, not somehow, turning it into an individual mantra.
It's like they turned "we the people," which is an inclusive phrase.
That's it.
It's supposed to mean everybody.
And so he found the group in it. He said, "We the people is us, not me," and that
not a particular group or ideology.
Republicans in Iowa who.
Yeah,
I mean, it does include everybody. I mean, the world what you notice about the world is that human beings are human beings.
But he said that it will only happen that we the people, the future we want, the opportunity and security for our families, a rising standard of living, peaceful planet for our kids will only happen if we change our politics. If we change our politics. You know, Obama's been criticized from the left, as you know, in this room, especially when the mics are off, for not being tougher with their insanity. Gary wrote a whole 500-page book just collecting the lies of the last few years. He had to cut it off because the lies are coming every day, because it's become such an effective politics. Lying has become effective politics. Obama recognized it, and that's what has to change.
And the liars so dominate the media that they shout down everyone else. I mean, 92% of all talk radio, I mean, we're the exception. 92% is conservative, not just Republican,
so
it's right wing.
Gary, yeah. Isn't there? There's so much money behind. See, there's two different ways of looking at corruption. And the Republican way is that its government is always corrupt. And they spent years trying to tag the Obama administration with a bunch of corruption. None of it actually stuck. Solyndra, all that stuff. It was all nonsense. None of it stuck. No indictments, no anything. And that's because it was all phony. So that's their sense of corruption. Government is corrupt. I think on the liberal, democratic, moderate side, what's really concerning us is something that Mike and Gary have talked about a bunch, which is the oligarchy spreading, the increased power. Can you have a democracy and have unlimited spending, political spending by the super rich? We're getting away with it now, but it won't last forever. You see one pair of brothers and their friends coming up with more money than the Republican Party, having organizers in all little towns now.
There's a report out this morning from Forbes, you know, that really liberal left-wing...
Oh, it's a lefty
magazine. There's a report out this morning that 62 people, mostly white, older men, now control as much wealth as half of the world's population.
I heard it on the BBC last night. They read it right out of Forbes. On the BBC, they said 62 guys control half of the world's wealth.
And I know Mike and Gary agree with me, but we'd like you folks to really think about this. If you have unlimited campaign contributions by the wealthy, can you really have a democracy in that situation?
Well, these 62
guys looking more and more like you actually can't have a democracy and have this massive often secret.
Well, guys, we've connected it. We did the Princeton study. There is no democracy. America is not a democracy. It is an oligarchy. So, no, you're exactly right. It's already happened.
And I'd like to point out that it's the result of a pattern of obstruction and laws from the Republican Party that refuse to, we've intentionally reduced the tax rate on capital gains, which allows these people to make more and more and more money. We've reduced the tax rates for them.
Increase investment, though, Gary.
It's been proven wrong.
Trickle down. All the money's going to trickle down.
It's been proven wrong since the 1800s and before. That trickle-down economics simply does not work. But these people have this massive amount of wealth because of policies instituted by Republicans. Yet they turn around and want to blame this now on the Obama administration.
I think the Democrats are partially at fault, too. They have not resisted. When you're in the minority, I don't know what you can do. I mean, they certainly have resisted a lot of the worst policies that have come along. But many of them, the problem is the system of money tends to taint everyone or has the potential to. You have to be a real tough guy to my wife worked for a very, very high official in New York City government. And he said in exasperation to her one time, he said, "I don't mind these guys who are heavy contributors to the politics coming in and trying to get their brother-in-law a job. All I want them to do is to present me with a brother-in-law who has some qualifications for the job they want me to get. I don't mind bending a little bit, but I'm not going to, And it was one of these non-public statements, one of these just, he was just totally exasperated by the pressure to appoint all these people who had made contributions and all their relatives.
Well, that's it. I mean, the governors, the mayors, the Senate, the House, these are all wholly owned people by various money interests.
And when they're not, think about Ann Kirkpatrick is running for the Senate. She's already spending all her time raising money. I mean, and in her last directions, she gets, little bits of money here and there, a few big contributors. But the whole, and it's not even just the Democrats. Republicans and Democrats should spend all their time fundraising.
Well, that's it.
Nobody's running. Thinking about the country.
And it's not a choice because they've seen it. Ann Kirkpatrick will have to raise money. And she will be viewed by those people with money that if she her ability to raise money determines her ability to get the office. It's that simple.
It's necessary just to have a chance because there will be so much dark money aimed against her. If you look back at the last election in 2014, all of the commercials, virtually every commercial you saw for Doug Ducey for governor was a commercial. It looked like a Doug Ducey for governor commercial, but in reality, it was a commercial from a PAC or a super PAC or a welfare, social welfare organization that coordinated with his campaign and spent the money in place of him.
Right. This wasn't money that Doug Ducey went out and raised through speeches or through anything else or through back rooms. This was money that people spent on his behalf because they wanted to control him when he's in office.
So I guess when I look at the president's speech, I see somebody trying to rebalance this extraordinarily negative and apocalyptic, ugly, nasty Republican campaign with a more positive a view of America's future and a more positive view of where we're at. Certainly his facts are almost entirely correct. The problem is that in doing that, he also de-emphasized some of the deeper structural problems, like the problem we have with the oligarchy in the United States, with the problem with so much of the world. I think, what I see, guys, is that even Democrats still have a inflated view of what America can and cannot do. I mean, you see it the worst when George Bush tries to go in and remake Iraq and remake whole countries. But Americans are still demanding a level of American interference in the world that we can't really deliver. I mean, there's an attack by these terrorists in a African country. We have 60 soldiers there. The French are there helping them. And the terrorists attack and kill a bunch of people. There's no easy solution to these things. And people are not being honest. There's no absolute way to prevent all terrorist attacks against the United States. It just can't be done. We do not win every battle. The United States continues because it loses battle. The Revolutionary War is a great example of losing one battle after another and then winning in the end.
And I would point out that these terrorist attacks often are aimed at Muslims. Contrary to the Republican worldview that all Muslims are evil and they're the source of all terrorism, we had, you know, just recently a huge attempted attack in Jakarta, Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country. We've seen terrorist attacks throughout Iraq and other countries in the Middle East against Muslims. It's Muslims against Muslims, but it's the extreme Muslims doing it. It's a very small percentage. And when we blame all Muslims for the terrorism, we only make matters worse.
I just can't believe the Republicans want to fall into exactly the type of trap that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the other extremists want, which is to get the United States into a war with the second largest religion in the world to denounce the religion. Put yourself in their place. Suppose we had we have the extremists doing it, but suppose we had people denouncing radical Christianity and saying, look at the Christians, the Crusaders are coming back to take our land. That's what ISIS is saying.
I wish he had addressed that, because he talked about Guantanamo being the big recruiting poster. He needed to say exactly what you're saying. He needed to say this Republican stance on this issue is the best recruiting that they have. And so to go somewhere, to go into Syria, to go into Africa countries, they want us to do that because it will be a great recruitment tool. As Gary just pointed out, they've lost 40%.
Yeah, ISIS is even more apocalyptic than at least the Republican rhetoric, which is they want to draw the United States into a war in Syria because they believe that the apocalypse will happen in a battle where they will defeat the Crusaders. That's throughout. They're holding a grudge for the last, 800 years?
It's based on Wahhabi Islam, which is a very narrow, extreme sect that was spawned in Saudi Arabia and exported with Saudi money to Western Pakistan and to other countries around the world.
Let me just turn in. We don't normally talk about what a single columnist says, and probably a lot of you folks don't read David Brooks. And the New York Times has always had strong conservative columnists as well as liberal ones. They want to have a spectrum. Now they're coming from a particular point of view. Brooks is extremely conservative guy, and he irritates liberals. Some of his arguments are particularly irritating, and he takes very conservative stances on things and phrases. But see what you guys think about it. He recently wrote a column, and he's a Republican, diehard Republican, called The Brutalism of Ted Cruz. And he starts the column by about a 1997 case where a young man was arrested for stealing a calculator from Walmart. This crime, he says, carried a maximum 2-year prison, but the prosecutors incorrectly applied the habitual offender law. Neither the judges nor the defense lawyer caught the error. Haley was sentenced to 16 years. Eventually, a mistake came to light, and Haley tried to fix it. Ted Cruz, the Solicitor General of Texas at that time, instead of letting Haley go for the time served. He took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. And Justice Kennedy said to him, is there some rule that you can't confess error in your state? They made a mistake. Cruz is the kind of man who's so vindictive that he didn't want to correct a mistake. He wouldn't admit a mistake.
He'd rather have a guy suffer in jail.
And so, Brooks, this is really revealing of the man's character. But he's the irony is he's running very strongly with evangelical voters. Stephen King, the radical crazy guy who's the congressman
from Iowa,
has endorsed him. They're big guys, and you know Brooks comes from a more so what we would, everybody has a different idea of what Christianity or Buddhism or anything or Islam is, but he says. When you look at Cruz, he has none of the Christian virtues at all. He doesn't even play a game of pretending. And Christian virtues, according to Brooks, are humility, mercy. This is, according to Pope Francis, supposed to be the year of mercy.
Yeah.
Compassion and grace.
Yeah.
And Cruz
has none of them.
Has none of them.
He's He's the opposite of all of those.
That's right. And so Brooks, who's sort of a religious man, calls it pagan brutalism. And I'm not sure that's fair to pagans.
I like it.
I think it's
there
really
is not a hint of compassionate gentleness or mercy. Instead, his speeches are marked, I'm reading directly from book, with a long list of enemies and vow to crush, shred, destroy, and bomb them. When he's speaking in a church, the contrast between the setting and the tone he takes is jarring. Cruz lays down an atmosphere of apocalyptic fear. America is heading off the cliff to oblivion. After one Democratic debate, he said, "We are seeing our freedoms taken away every day." And last night was an audition for who would wear the jackboot most vigorously. This is, I mean, I don't know how much you give it. Let's see. The fact is, Brooks says, this apocalyptic diagnosis, and he's just a regular kind of conservative guy, is ridiculous. The Obama administration has done things that people like me strongly agree with. But America is in better economic shape than any other country on earth. Crime is down. Abortion rates are down. 14 million new jobs have been created in 5 years, which is sort of what Mike was reading about from the president's speech. And he says Obama has championed a liberal agenda, but he hasn't made the country unrecognizable. He said in 2008, federal spending accounted for 20.3% of the gross domestic product. In 2015, it accounted for 20.9%.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Government. Nikki Haley's speech talked about the Republican response about a government getting bigger. It just flat isn't.
It isn't true.
Obama talked about what I liked in his speech. Wrapping up, we only got a few minutes left. That American leadership in the 20. I'm quoting now. American leadership in the 21st century is not a choice between ignoring the rest of the world, except when we kill terrorists. Or occupying and rebuilding whatever society is unraveling. Leadership means a wise application of military power and rallying the world behind causes that are right. And we can't do that, and I'm stopped quoting now, unless we at least take some positions that have some humility and some moral high ground.
I should say this is David Brooks's article, Brutalism of Ted Cruz. He's also given an interview on public television, in the New York Times, and it appeared January 12th, if you guys want to read the whole thing.
The thing that stands out to me about that is that all the things that we, you know, are afraid of are diminished. Violence is down, the deficit is dropping, it's everything that they want us to be afraid of. is diminishing.
That's the paradox, isn't it?
Yet the fear is increasing, and as I said before, it's the result of a pattern of propaganda that's intrusive throughout our entire society.
Now, immigration can always cause instability in countries if it gets to a certain rate.
I have to say this.
It tends to cause problems. But we have nothing like the immigration project problem that they have in Europe. There are millions of people on the move as a result of starvation and war and violence and sectarian conflict. What I think is the most difficult thing for Americans and the whole world to face is how interconnected we are. And the answer is, how do you feel this interconnection and try to deal with this interconnection without being a bully, without attacking everything with military might, without lecturing everybody and trying to turn them into mini Americans? I mean, because when small things happen in parts of the world, it reverberates over the whole world now. A problem of poverty in one African country and a drought, climate change, then sends off tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees.
Well, and conversely, helping that African country helps us. In other words, our foreign relations, our help, our financing is part of our foreign policy that helps us because of exactly what you said. You know, Obama's trying to get a country that likes to ignore the rest of the world, except when it kills terrorists.
I think that's a great
point. To realize
exactly
what you said, that our interconnectedness now, and we're not just talking about internet, you know, but somehow that what
happens
with the
internet.
The world
is interconnected now in a way that we can't seem to ignore problems, but we can't also deal with them in the way that we did in the past.
Yeah, but a lot of Americans don't
believe that. What I would say in criticism of Democrats, too, is that almost none of them have faced this problem. The deep interconnectedness of the world. Well, we're going to fight with the Chinese about this, and then suddenly the Chinese economy is in trouble, and now much of the world is in trouble because of nothing we did.
When I think of the markets crashing over the last couple of weeks or dropping dramatically, I'm reminded of that whole butterfly theory with the climate, that a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, and it ultimately results in a storm in North America.
See, that's not a metaphysical idealistic concept, right, Gary?
Right.
That's the way it actually is now, yes. And in getting more so. So when a problem is not addressed in any part of the world, and we can do a whole program on this, but to me, we have to strengthen international organization, the UN, the NGOs, people like Doctors Without Borders. Well,
and what has held our economy back over the last 7 years is not just policies here, but it was the austerity programs in Europe. And the Europe economies were so slowly rebounding that it was impacting us. Now it's China, so it's all connected.
So, Mike, who's going to be on the show next week? I think we have a really good show coming up.
We got a really really interesting candidate, a nice lady, Nikki Bagley, will be on from former mayor of Jerome.
She's running for state senator.
She's running for state senate, a breath of fresh air in an otherwise. I did put on my Facebook page that 40% of the state legislature is Democratic, and they deserve our support. We will be changing that 40%, I believe, this time around, because the single issue of education, all three of our representatives, Senate from this area, from LD6, said they were going to support education. None of them have. None of them have. We are... It's sad. It's sad beyond belief. As we close the show here on this Martin Luther King Day, we want to talk about Democrats at the Red Rocks Breakfast, 8 a.m. On the this 18th. That's just a couple days from now. Paul Johnson from Phoenix. Is he going to talk about open primaries?
Yes, he is. He's the former mayor of Phoenix.
Former mayor of Phoenix. This ought to be interesting. A Democrat, I guess he's still registered a Democrat. We'll find out. But he's going to talk about open primaries. There is
the secret of the door breakfast is they're a lot of fun.
They are. This one's going to be fun. Please come to this one. It's going to be wild. The whole open primary thing is don't forget, vbid.org. You can hear the brilliance on this show and all our shows on vbid.org. We have our podcasts there. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. Lots of exciting stuff coming up.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catches every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.